The business revolution starts today. We stopped the burning. We found a better way.
Welcome, or welcome back to The Business Revolution, the podcast where we are rewriting the rules of business for a sustainable future. I'm Cherry, your co-host.
And I'm Alan.
And I'm Mick. And we are your guides on this journey to explore the intersection of business, sustainability, and positive change.
Each episode, we will bring you inspiring conversations with experts, entrepreneurs, and change makers who are proving that sustainability isn't just good for the planet, it's good for business too.
We uncover innovative solutions, we share practical strategies, and we discover the new trends that will shape the future of sustainable business.
So whether you are a seasoned CEO, a budding entrepreneur, or simply curious about how to make a difference, you've come to the right place here.
So grab a cup of your favorite sustainable brew, settle in, and get ready to be inspired. This is The Business Revolution. Now the business revolution starts with you.
The business revolution starts today. In this episode, we're going to explore the exciting frontier of sustainable agriculture and renewable energy, and how innovative technology is transforming the way we grow food.
And to help us explore this intersection of farming, technology, and environmental stewardship, we're excited to welcome Stephen Todd.
Stephen is the founder and CEO of Volt Pharma, a company at the forefront of bringing cutting-edge renewable energy solutions to the agricultural sector. With a deep passion for sustainable farming practices and a keen eye for technological innovation, Stephen is empowering farmers to reduce their environmental footprint, cut costs, and build more resilient operations. He's driving a quiet revolution in rural Australia, proving that profitable farming and planetary health can go hand in hand. Welcome, Stephen, to the Business Revolution.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen, could you share your story behind Volt Pharma? So, you know, what's your core mission and how are you bringing renewable energy solutions to the agricultural sector?
We describe our activities as being regenerative. So we essentially go into communities, identify the opportunities, work with the existing experts in the area. We find consensus among the technology players, but also the ancient wisdom of the area. We use precision regenerative agricultural techniques to measure and baseline the existing performance of the landscape and the energy systems. And then using AI-based systems, we create outcomes, because they're called actionable insights from that data. So it all sounds very cold and clinical, but it's actually about using ancient wisdom. And a lot of the ancient farming cultures that we actually deal with use an intuitive basis when they're managing the landscape. When they walk onto a farm, they can feel whether it's in tune or whether it's out of tune. And to give you a basic example, you walk onto a farm that the soil feels soft underfoot, it's likely full of biological activity. If you're very quiet, as a lot of the older farmers will be, you can hear the birds and the insects, so that's a bioindicator. And you're basically feeling the vibration. Now, with modern technology, we can start to put measurement onto that using bioacoustics, actually listening to what the landscape's telling us and looking for trends in that landscape. So we look at a whole system. We actually basically design the system like an ecologically balanced trophic cascade. So we're looking at what's pushing what's the best way to actually live in harmony, to produce what you want and long-term productive assets for the owner.
That's wonderful. And talking about, obviously you're educating us, we're not farmers, and so there's so much in there. I'm wondering, a lot of people like myself, or people who are not aware of farming, think, well, that sounds great, but what is the value of that to modern farming?
There's a couple of big reasons. One is to increase the carrying capacity of your farm. A carrying capacity is the ability to carry animals or produce crops. It also makes the farms more drought resilient or climate event resilient. You're understanding the trends, so you're actually being able to react to change better outcomes. Traditionally, data collection is about telling you what you already know. If you go back to the older way of doing it, it's looking where the birds roosting in the trees. That will tell you what next year's weather is going to be, where the insects are putting their nests. There's lots of stuff that we can take to them. People actually understand the landscape. And once you understand that, you can apply a thing called the landscape wellness rating system to understand at this point in time, where does that landscape sit? So as an investor, if you want to be cold and commercial, you're ideally looking to buy a farm that's a one star, use an applied set of systems to then renovate to a seven star. And if you want to be a banker or an investor, you then have got a long-term productive asset. The actual farm operator then, when you're getting these really strange changes in the climate or long-term droughts, because you've looked after it well, it's a much more resilient, ecologically based farming system. And Australia leads the world in a lot of this technology.
Wow. So if I understand that correctly, you're saying that not only do you get actually higher productivity, but you get quick wins. So it's not like a long wait for return on investment. And you've got resilience built into that. Is that a good summary, a correct summary?
The summary in the middle is maybe not correct, because there's a thing called the valley of death. So whenever people transition from chemical agronomy, so that's a lot of artificial synthetic fertilizers, high yields, if you want to go either organic or regenerative, there's probably a 3 to 5 year period in the middle where you're repairing the ecosystem. You also get a lot of grief from your neighbors traditionally because your farm looks untidy. It also requires you to be more resilient in your thinking, so you're not just growing soybeans or corn. You're actually growing things like food forests, so you're creating a completely different system. Some of the solar systems we use actually mimic an agroforestry system, so the solar panels actually hang vertically, and that means that we can then grow traditional crops like barley, carrots, potatoes, anything you want in between them. But that requires a level of investment, but it also requires quite a lot of faith in the farmer's perspective, because the banks are still fairly far behind, because they're basing all their loans on predictive algorithms. What sold last year? What's the commodity market? And that's been the biggest challenge, particularly in Australia, where a lot of the traditional A-based banks, and you only have four of them, don't like things that appear to be innovative. But in fact, they're quite the opposite of innovative. They're old-fashioned, they're robust.
Stephen, I'm interested in terms of, I was looking at your website and, you know, the renewable energy aspect of it. How does it all work, you know, for our listeners? Because I think often when we think about renewables, whether it's solar or wind, there's a, seems to be, I may be incorrect in assuming, a bit of resistance in those areas around having solar farms on farms and the impact. Is there any impact?
Yes, there has been a very bad impact in Australia in particular, simply because the developers who have come from other parts of the world are engineers and they build monocultured solar farms. They have very little community engagement. And lessons can be taken from the German wind industry, where, again, they were doing something similar and the German communities were getting extremely upset with what they thought were visually unpleasant looking wind farms that they were looking at. What the Germans did, the German companies, they went to local community and said, okay, we've got your feedback. If you were allowed to invest in these wind farms as a co-investor, would that change? And overnight it transformed the narrative completely, because it became the community's wind farm or solar farm. And then in the UK, there was a company called Lightsource BP. And they were my original inspiration for what I'm doing with my projects, where we combine elevated solar with actual farming underneath. So we're not talking about putting some sheep in it and pretending it's farming. It's actually baselining the soil health, having a farm management system, moving the animals around holistically to optimize the amount of soil carbon sequestrated, having proper buffer zones around the periphery, like a 20 or 30 meter native biocorridor. They were brilliant at actually saying this can be done. The problem in Australia, a lot of it's been run by pure financial return. And none of that value goes back to the local community. None, zilch, nothing. They say it creates jobs. Once a farm's built, and most of those jobs are outsourced anyway, the money just goes into the national energy market and the market traders. So there have been some amazing innovative companies in Australia, like Como Energy, who've been pushing that syndicated investment opportunity for local companies and local people who want to invest in it. So if you're a local mill and you want to have really good ESG commitments, like genuine, you would co-invest in a solar farm. It's a community-owned solar farm. But it also means that it's demonstrable. You can link the solar farm to your end use and say, for every kilowatt hour that we're using, we can actually show it's come directly from that solar farm. That the problem with the larger farms that are happening is that they are been developed by people, I mean, with no disrespect, because they're engineers, you know, they want to optimize the electricity. This is really coming from Germany, New Mexico, and France, and Italy. They're saying that land is so precious, we need to make it coexist. Australia now is starting to really pick up the ante on this. And yes, they're combining sheep, but they're also looking at the hydrological function, the insects, the pollinators. How can we screen it from the local community? How can we actually include schools education from day one so the kids get to see how do you assess the natural capital? What are your biometrics as you go forward? And also then align local communities to have access through corporate PPAs or town PPAs to buy the electricity. And you're going to see something similar at the minute with the large utility battery systems that they're building. You've got to involve your local community as an actual stakeholder, not as a, I've ticked the box, I've spoken to the community in the LC mapping. You've actually got to offer people that democracy of, do you want to be part of it?
It sounds to me as if it's sort of taking, you mentioned the ideas coming from Germany and a few other countries. It's also, you mentioned the ancient knowledge. And it seems to be a pattern that I'm hearing here, is that ancient knowledge of the indigenous culture and ancient knowledge, in, if you look at any other farming, I'm guessing, but that idea of diversity, that you need the different, you need to encourage the bees and the pollinators and all of the other things to be together. And you're sort of expanding that by putting the solar and wind on the same place as your farms. So you've sort of diversifying a lot more. Is that a reasonable understanding?
You're making your farming enterprise much more resilient because it's called value stacking. Like in the 1940s until, you know, the end of the Second World War in the UK, a farmer would have had geese, they would have had milking cows, they would have made cheese on the farm, they would have grown some of their own fodder. And they would have a series of different enterprises that allowed them, regardless of what happened, that there was always income from the farm. But when you look at nature, nothing works as an isolated activity. Everything, it's a circle of life. The challenge we've had after the Second World War has been such an explosion in mouths to feed. And obviously after the Second World War, they had an awful lot of phosphates left after the manufacturing of said ancillary devices. So they had to come up with some way of using it. And the problem is now you've got people addicted to chemical inputs. The beautiful thing about this sort of precision regenerative ag, it doesn't require people to go on a massive learning journey. It becomes pretty intuitive once they get a vibe of it. And some of the teaching that's coming from Australia and America, some people like Will Harris and White Oak Pastures, people like that who are going around the world saying, look, this is a system, but you've got to actually understand what you're trying to achieve. It's no criticism of the large petrochemical companies because they're fulfilling a need. Again, like large solar farm developers, you want 800 megawatts, we'll give it to you. Now, Australia, again, is really pushing hard with the Agri-Solar CRC bid being led by Western Sydney University. And they've brought together about 150 really, really good experts in regenerative agriculture, biocarbon, biochar, landscape management, as well as solar farming and engineering. And they've really started that systems-based approach, which is really, really exciting.
Stephen, can you give us a picture of the scale of this? How far are you yourself and how large or how small is your business? And also, what's your perspective on how do we scale this up so that more people, more farmers and more, you know, countries basically begin to use that thinking that you're presenting us to here?
It needs to be legislated and quickly. Australia's got a unique opportunity here with land tax and primary production rules. Simply to say that any solar farm or bioenergy plant needs to include and incorporate agriculture in a meaningful way. That would solve the problem overnight. Italy has already done something similar. France insists that all new buildings and car parks either have grass or solar panels on them. So government needs to lead the way. The market's pushed pretty hard in this, but as you can see, the perverse outcome is monoculture, 800 hectare solar farms with all the power, you know, literally going to the energy traders. So if government just, it is simple, it's just a legislation. If you do it that way, you're going to be commercially taxed like it's a industrial building in the middle of Sydney. If you do it this way, it's primary production.
And are you talking with government?
That's me biting my lip. The Solar CRC with Western Sydney University will have that opportunity to put that case to people who can actually make an effect. Where we're actually making a bigger difference at the minute is in Zambia, because they're in the middle of a terrible drought and their solar farm permits are now taking 48 hours. A solar farm in Australia can take you between 7 to 10 years to get permits and get actually on the ground. So it can be done. They've realised that because 84% of their electricity comes from hydroelectric, we've got no water, we've got no electricity, 22 hours a day with no power. They've got 60% of their communities under 25. Young, excited people on iPhones, Samsungs, using AI, are really connected to the interweb of knowledge, going, we want to do something different. So they contacted me last year and said, we've seen what you're doing in Australia. Can you come and do something with us? So we looked at what they were doing and we quickly realized that the agriculture we can bring, the systems we can bring, the education, the digital twins, the immediate plugging in of a solar and battery system creates that power directly to Lusaka and Livingston. And we've been very well received and they've been incredibly good at co-design, leaning in, seeing how they can help. They have been very open to the carbon farming. They've been very open to the food forests, very, very open to collaboration with Australia and Denmark, of all places. Europe, believe it or not, Denmark, Sweden, UK, Ireland, Scotland are all pushing into Zambia because there's a lot of really clever people who are keen to actually make a difference with their careers.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story about Zambia and where they're actually getting the buy-in and actually moving forward. And hopefully they're going to be examples for us over here. You mentioned the long regulations, for example. I know here in Gippsland, there's a small town called Locke, who had a big natural disaster a few years ago. And they've got together and they're actually trying their best to have their own local micro power system that they can use as their resilience. It's a rural community, so I'm guessing it would have an impact on their farming and their opportunities that they'd get from it as well. I'm wondering if you think that Zambia would be a good example that might be a leverage point to help those plant a few more seeds that people can see grow because there is already local buy-in.
What we're seeing in Zambia is because 60% of their population is under 25. They have grown up with access to the internet. The vast majority of people we're talking to already have iPhone 14s and 15s, tablets. They don't have the conditioning that a lot of the Western societies have, so they don't know what they don't know. And that's an amazing opportunity, particularly when you tie it into AI systems that are now giving you actionable insights. So it's like talking to a bunch of unpolluted eight-year-olds in a classroom where, why not? We want to do this. It's been done before. Or we can use this technology. What's the problem? Because they're not aware of what Australians are conditioned to think about regulation and about what won't work because they don't know what won't work, which is brilliant. And you're much more likely to get innovation, particularly when people are under, you know, fiscal stress and climate stress and food stress and energy stress. They have no option but to work something out. And that is great at nation building because people together are actually much stronger. The great expression about Australia is it's comfortably numb. And then, unfortunately, people take their eye off the ball. And again, that's not a criticism. I'm an Australian citizen. I love the place. But perhaps the areas that you can reflect on in Australia, when they have a bushfire, people tend to work as communities and help each other out. A bit like when you're training as a cyclist, the only time you get fitter is when you're going up the hill.
Stephen, you mentioned AI there before, and I want to explore this with you a little bit because I think it's such an interesting space we're in. How do you see that impacting farming, but also adoption of AI? How does it all intersect?
The beautiful thing about AI, if you know how to write the question and then ask the key secret, you have to start with the end in sight, and then you have to set up human-based protocols about the actual outcome process. The beautiful thing is it's dipping into the entire knowledge of humanity forever. And when you think about it, to have that in your pocket, if you'd said that even 10 years ago, people would have laughed. Now you can actually go, give me an example of how to repair this landscape so it creates social benefit, economically viable, produces power for the community, ensures women employment, ensures that people who actually want to be getting an agency in their future can do so, that also promotes a collaboration between different countries. AI immediately just removes those barriers because it doesn't know what those barriers are. So it's a beautiful moment in time. The danger is making sure that, unlike the Wizard of Oz, we actually have that distributed ethic built into it. And that's going to be the biggest challenge because, again, obviously, the propagandists who can populate the interweb for AI to find, or even the controlled AI systems, which then are siloed. You've got to find somewhere in the middle. But the advantage for the Zambian communities and certainly the rural communities we deal with in Australia is that it's freeing them up from that bias that even the best consultant brings, because it's giving them multiple sources of truth. It's also giving you an automatic bibliography. Where did I get that? What's the rationale? You can interrogate it. So it's an amazingly interesting time. It's like with the start of the interweb. Those that saw it got it immediately and thought, my goodness, this is going to be fun.
Hmm. However, the next step after AI is robots, isn't it? You know, when it's not just a brain, but it actually has a body and it can start working on farms. China is already rolling out robots, for instance, to take care of elders in Japan. It's a big thing as well. We haven't seen much of it yet in Australia. What's your take on that next level of AI when it gets physical?
We actually already have it in Australia. The Swarm Robotics in Queensland already have systems that go out and do exactly what's needed. They use lasers to identify and burn the weeds. We already have drone swarms on farms that automatically go out, read the number of raspberries. That information goes straight back into the financial records of that farm, so the bank and the investors know at any point what's that crop yield. The commodities investors know that what it's going to be next year based on what they can see. So we're already there. And what's happening now with robotization, yes, it's going to remove some jobs, but it's like the transition between the horse and the car. I mean, that was 10, 15 years, and horses weren't just horses. It was the saddlers, it was the hoofers, it was the carriage makers. Humans have always had to adapt to change, no different to when there was massive coal mines in the UK or making linen. Things change, synthetics come along, people adapt. But I think there's a new generation have grown up with this. It's called mother. It's the fact that you have this Gaia system that will give you the information with the best intention, as long as you don't have the bad people in the background giving you propaganda. But the beautiful thing about some of these young people, they've grown up with Reddit. They know how to question things. They've got social confirmation. And they don't just go to Google and say, well, if it's above the line, that's the truth. They know to ask those questions. And I don't think robotics will take away a lot of the menial jobs, like, you know, sewer cleaning and doing all the horrible stuff. But there's still going to be work for people, and there's going to be work. I mean, one thing that AI can't do particularly well is design-based thinking. It's beyond, because it doesn't have emotional intelligence yet. And that will be interesting to see how that script develops. So people will always have a place.
Yeah, great. One last question for me. So many of our listeners are business leaders across various industries, Stephen. What lessons from the work that you do from agriculture and regenerative farming that can be applied into other industries or sectors?
The application of predictive algorithms and looking for trends. So most data collection in businesses is what your accountant tells you, and that's last year's effect. And unfortunately, then you're reacting to what you're actually, it's too late. What we're seeing now with regenerative practice, you're looking for, they're called surrogate indicators, so you get to see what's going to happen before it's happened, because certain things have already started to shift in the wind. And most businesses can take that policy and see what's happening. If it's an engineering business, you can have machine learning in your VSD, so those are electronic motors in your system. And if they start to underperform, the system automatically detects as an underperforming asset, so you can then have predictive maintenance. And again, they've managed to, sounds a bit creepy, watch people's behavior at work so they know when people are getting fed up, and you do not want fed up workers. You want to keep people motivated. And there's an app now, you can actually watch people on the peninsula. We can see all the tradespeople leaving in the morning and all the tradespeople from Melbourne CBD coming down to the peninsula. So the analytics are already there, and you can see the patterns, and you can start to build a better regenerative future, saying, well, why are so many people traveling an hour down and an hour up to do the work that the people who are already there, from even a lifestyle point of view, why do you want to sit in a car for 2 hours? You know, so businesses have got that great opportunity now of, it sounds like rationalizing your business, but you're actually making it more livable. And if you keep people happy and a good quality of life, it becomes a productive asset.
That was beautiful. And it's, you know, some of the work that Alan and I've been trying to do is, you know, how do we take a regenerative approach into the world of business. Stephen, where can our listeners learn more about you, your work, and Vault Farmer?
mainly either on the website, which is voltfarmer.com.au, but we do a lot on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is the most amazing device. We have had so many conversations from people that are totally unrelated to what we're doing, who said, you know, we work in the medical sector. We've got predictive algorithms to spot health issues. We want to talk to you about using predictive algorithms in landscaping to identify how farmers can predict the water's drying up or the algae levels or the biological oxygen demand of the water's changed, which means there must be pollution. And it's a great way of meeting, you know, engineers, environmentalists, ethical people, people who want to talk about weird and wonderful stuff because they get inspiration. And when you have two people in a conversation, a third voice turns up, it's one that you weren't expecting. And LinkedIn is great because you tend not to get negative comments. It's generally people going, that's fascinating, tell me more. Or we're working with oil transport ships and how we've reduced the carbon footprint is making sure that we wait until the tide's at the highest level, then we overfill the boat and we've saved 20%. So you get to share these amazing insights from other industries that you would never have come across.
Oh, that's brilliant. We'll make sure we'll add your LinkedIn page so people can follow that and connect with you as well, Stephen. Thank you. And that's a wrap for this episode of The Business Revolution. We hope you have enjoyed diving deep into the world of business and sustainability with us.
As you can see, the world of business and sustainability is not just business as usual. It's a broader thing across farming and the community. So remember, the revolution doesn't end there. It's up to each and every one of us to take the knowledge and inspiration from today's episode and turn it into action.
Mm. And whether that action is implementing sustainable practices in your own business or advocating for change in your community, every step, every single step counts towards building a better future for us all.
And don't forget to visit our website at businessrevolution.earth for more resources, past episodes, and ways to get involved.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review The Business Revolution on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us reach more listeners and amplify our impact.
Thank you for joining us on this journey of transformation together. We hope we can revolutionize the way we do business and create a world that is truly sustainable for the generations to come.
Stay tuned for insights, inspiration, and actionable steps to help reshape the way we all do business for a better tomorrow.
So until next time, keep innovating, keep inspiring, and keep pushing for positive change for a brighter tomorrow. This is Cherry.
I'm Mick.
And Alan, signing off. The business revolution starts with you.